page 468, chapter 19, A Step Backward for Civil Rights. Chapter preview, terms, Jim Crow laws, separate but equal doctrine, lynching, Great Migration, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, disfranchise, white primary, grandfather clause, prejudice, anti-Semitism, commute. People, Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, Lucy Craft Laney, Joseph Winthrop Holly, John Hope, Lugenia Burns Hope, Leo Frank. Places, Sweet Auburn. The late 1800s to early 1900s was a period of change in some ways and continuity in others. Georgians had mixed feelings about change. Some, especially whites, wanted to hold on to the past and return to life as it had been before the Civil War. Among other things, this involved keeping other groups of people in the places in society they had always held. Even though these Georgians accepted the end of slavery, they believed African Americans would have the same status as free blacks before the Civil War, limited freedom but not equality. Without Northern supervision, a new caste system began to emerge in the South. African Americans in Georgia hoped to have the greater equality that the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution seemed to offer. These hopes ran into the determination of most whites to keep them in a place of inferiority. At first, threats and violence became the means of enforcement. Then laws began to change. Racial segregation became established by law and custom. African American men also lost their right to vote through measures designed to get around the 15th Amendment. In spite of that, African Americans built religious, business, and educational institutions that provided for them what was denied them in the white community. While their situations were different from African Americans, other groups also suffered from discrimination, especially Catholics and Jews. Page 470, Section 1, African Americans and Segregation. As you read, look for methods used to enforce segregation, African American response to segregation, African American leaders of the period, the birth of the NAACP, terms, Jim Crow laws, separate but equal doctrine, lynching, Great Migration, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The late 1800s and early 1900s was a period when prejudice resulted in growing inequality, separateness, and even violence. As change occurred, those who had enjoyed superiority in Southern society based on their race, religion, and gender felt their status threatened. That led to laws, practices, and sometimes violence as white Protestant men tried to maintain their place. African Americans were the major target. By the end of the period, laws and customs had created a second-class citizenship. A major step toward this lower status was the establishment of legalized segregation. The establishment of segregation. One of the most significant methods to maintain white supremacy in society was the passage of segregation laws. As you learned, segregation meant that blacks and whites would be separated in many aspects of their lives. Schools were segregated from the end of the Civil War, and most churches were separate. In practice, some public places, such as restaurants, were becoming segregated, although no laws required separation. The U.S. Congress had passed a Civil Rights Act in 1875, which made discrimination in public places illegal. But in the 1880s, in a series of cases called the Civil Rights Cases, The Supreme Court had said that while the government could not discriminate, it could not prevent owners of private businesses from deciding who they would serve. That had opened the door to segregation in public places. Jim Crow laws. Throughout the 1890s and early 1900s, both the state of Georgia and local communities passed laws and ordinances calling for segregation or Jim Crow laws. The term Jim Crow had been used in the mid-1800s for a type of black character in minstrel shows. White performers blackened their faces and sang and danced in a way that made fun of African Americans. The term became a racial slur. Jim Crow was first connected to segregation in the North before the Civil War. There, some railroad cars were segregated and called Jim Crow cars. The term survived and became the nickname for the new laws that Southern states passed to create a second-class, separate, and inferior position for African Americans. Jim Crow laws were somewhat like the early black codes that Southern states had tried to enact right after the Civil War. Those had been disallowed during military reconstruction. Before the passage of Jim Crow laws, customs and intimidation had already created a system of white superiority in Georgia and other Southern states. Jim Crow laws made the practice of segregation legal. Because segregation by race meant defining race, states passed laws saying how much African heritage a person had to have to be considered black. Plessy versus Ferguson. Railroad cars were among the public places that states segregated. Georgia passed such a law in 1891. A similar Louisiana law was challenged on purpose by African Americans who thought it was unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. Homer Plessy, who was 1/8 African American and 7/8 white in heritage, challenged the Louisiana law after he was removed from a first-class railroad car. In the famous 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that public places could be separate by race, but that they had to be equal. This separate but equal doctrine allowed segregation to continue in the United States for decades. Supreme Court Justice John Marshall Harlan disagreed with the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. He wrote that if the Supreme Court allowed separate train cars, it could lead to many other areas of segregation. He was right. With the separate but equal doctrine approved by the Supreme Court, Southern states began enacting dozens of state laws and local ordinances to create separate public spaces from cradle to grave, from separate schools and libraries to separate cemeteries. Racial segregation became established by law and custom. Cumming versus Richmond County Board of Education. The Supreme Court decision that first applied the separate but equal doctrine to education was a case from Georgia. Cumming versus Richmond County Board of Education. The 1899 Cumming decision allowed Richmond County to keep a white high school open while closing Ware High School for African American students. The court said the Richmond County Board of Education's decision to use the Ware High money for black elementary schools instead of the high school did not establish discrimination. The decision also acknowledged that not allowing African Americans in white schools was constitutional. In practice, the separate aspect of the doctrine was enforced, but the equal part was not. Preventing equality. These laws affected the lives of both black and white Georgians and had a profound impact on the relationship between the races. Public places became more and more separate. Blacks and whites continued to interact, however, especially in workplaces. For many African American women, that meant the homes of white families. While African Americans could shop in stores, they could not sit at lunch counters in those stores. courts used separate Bibles to swear in witnesses. Eventually, restrooms and water fountains were separate, as were the waiting rooms in railroad and streetcar stations. African Americans were excluded altogether from some public businesses, such as restaurants and hotels that served whites. In 1905, a Georgia law called for parks to be segregated. In areas where total separation would be expensive, such as theaters, separate areas to sit were designated. Colored-only and white-only signs began to appear throughout Georgia and the other southern states. They did not come down for decades. In addition to the laws establishing separate spaces, unspoken rules of how whites and blacks interacted emerged. Whites had the right-of-way on sidewalks and roadways. Whites, including children, called African Americans by their first names. African Americans, on the other hand, had to always use a title when speaking to whites, even children: Mr., Mrs., Sir, Ma'am, Master, or Miss. African Americans did not speak their minds to whites. They were expected to agree and obey. While some whites and blacks developed close personal relationships, especially between white employers and African American employees, those relationships were never equal. No matter how educated and wealthy African Americans became, they were always considered inferior to any whites. Threats and violence became the way to enforce the unspoken rules of racial standing. Children of both races learned these rules early. For black children, learning these rules could be important to their safety and well-being. As these new forms of racial interaction were emerging, Georgia went through a period of difficult racial tension and sometimes violence. A form of extreme violence was lynching. Lynching occurs when a mob of people murder someone. Hanging and shooting were the most common methods of killing. Historians have found that between 1882 and 1930, over 450 Georgians were lynched, around 95% of them African Americans. Only Mississippi had more of these murders. Lynching occurred most in Georgia's central and southern rural areas. The most active decades for lynching were the 1890s and the 1910s. In some cases, the victims had been accused of a crime, but were not given their due process rights. In other cases, however, the victim had simply angered a white in some way by getting out of his place or being uppity. Mobs of white men lynched without disguise, knowing that there would be no punishment. African American responses to segregation. African Americans had a variety of responses to the Jim Crow laws in the South. Some moved away. In the 1880s, a migration of African Americans from the South to the Great Plains began. During the Civil War, the U.S. Congress had passed the Homestead Act to encourage people to settle in the grassy, flat, windy plains. A family could become the owners of 160 acres of land, one-fourth of a square mile, if they lived on and farmed the land for 5 years. As attractive as the idea of land ownership was, the lure of living without fear of the KKK and other forms of intimidation and violence was a more important factor for many. African Americans who were part of this migration west were known as Exodusters. A.M.E. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, one of those legislators removed from the Georgia General Assembly during Reconstruction, became increasingly concerned that African Americans would not ever have equality in the United States. He was outraged by some of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions that did not live up to the protections that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed. He began to preach that African Americans should migrate to Africa. He visited the continent himself several times in the 1890s. While CME Bishop Lucius Henry Holsey did not support leaving the country, he too came to believe that white and black Southerners would never be able to live together in harmony. He had become especially disturbed after a particularly horrible lynching in Georgia. He developed the idea that the national government should establish a separate state in the West for African Americans, where they could live peacefully without whites and without discrimination. neither of those plans had many supporters. By the early 20th century, small numbers of African Americans began to move north. Those numbers grew after 1915. In that year, the KKK was refounded at Georgia Stone Mountain, and fears of violence against African Americans increased. Another draw to the North was jobs. Factory jobs increased when World War I began in Europe and the Allies bought U.S. goods. Even more jobs were created when the United States entered the war. The numbers of African Americans leaving the South became so great that this movement from South to North became known as the Great Migration. Booker T. Washington. In the late 19th and early 20th century, however, most African Americans did not leave. They had to cast down their buckets where they were. Those words were spoken by Booker T. Washington, a major leader for the black community during this time. Born into slavery in Virginia, Washington longed as a young boy to attend school as he saw his white owners' children doing. He wrote in his autobiography that he had the feeling that to get into a schoolhouse would be about the same as getting into paradise. Freed at the end of the Civil War, Washington worked hard in a West Virginia mine before becoming a houseboy for his mine's owner. The mine owner's wife taught Washington to read. At 16, he entered Hampton Institute in Virginia, where he worked his way through school. On the recommendation of his Hampton principal, he became the head of a new school for African Americans in Tuskegee, Alabama. He and his students met in a church while they built the school with their own hands. Washington believed that African Americans had to acquire the knowledge and skills that would help them find jobs and raise their economic status. He saw that as the number one priority. Therefore, he emphasized industrial or vocational education. He went around the country supporting African American education and raising money for his school and others. He became friends with some leading Northern whites who supported his cause. In 1895, the organizers of the International Cotton Exposition in Atlanta asked Washington to speak on the opening day. In his speech, Washington seemed to accept segregation by saying that in their social lives, blacks and whites could be as separate as the fingers, yet one as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress. He urged whites to employ African Americans. He hoped that equality would come, although he believed it would be gradual. This seeming acceptance of segregation and social inequality, in order to get along with Southern whites, became known as accommodation. Northern and Southern white leaders enthusiastically praised Washington's speech. To Washington, who had lived with Southern whites his entire life, this was a practical approach. He believed that it might result in better race relations and a gradual white acceptance of African-American equality. After the 1906 Atlanta riot, many began to question Washington's gradual approach. They began to think that, no matter how much African-Americans accomplished, whites would not accept them as social and political equals. W.E.B. Du Bois. In the early 1900s, an emerging African-American leader began to debate Washington's ideas. William Edward Burghardt W.E.B. Du Bois had grown up in Massachusetts, where he had been born free and had not faced the same racial attitudes. His first encounter with segregation came in 1885 when he went to Nashville, Tennessee to attend Fisk College. He was profoundly affected by his experience and began to develop his ideas of educating leaders for African Americans, leaders he called the Talented Tenth. He wanted them to have a liberal arts education to develop thinking and leadership skills. Du Bois graduated from Harvard with bachelor's and master's degrees, went to the University of Berlin for 2 years, and then returned to Harvard for a Ph.D. degree. In 1897, he was recruited to come to Atlanta University, where he not only taught, but also worked hard as a scholar, studying conditions for African Americans. His famous work, The Souls of Black Folk, was published in 1903. His own findings as he studied problems such as poverty and lynching led him to call for increased action. 2 years later, he was among black leaders who met at Niagara Falls to discuss ways of combating racial discrimination. Out of this meeting developed the Niagara Movement. Events of the next few years, including the Atlanta race riot and the loss of the right to vote, convinced Du Bois that African Americans would have to stir things up to achieve justice. The Niagara Movement joined with white liberals in 1909 to form the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. Du Bois started the organization's magazine, The Crisis. In 1910, he left Atlanta to work full-time with the NAACP in New York. Du Bois believed that African Americans should not take a gradual approach to civil rights and equality. He wanted to attack racism. For the rest of the 20th century, the NAACP took cases of discrimination to court to try to get the nation to live up to the promises of the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. Reviewing the section, 1. Define separate but equal doctrine, lynching, Great Migration, NAACP. 2. What did the decision in Plessy v. Ferguson accomplish? 3. What did the decision in Cumming v. Richmond County Board of Education accomplish? Page 479 of Special Interest, Cumming v. Richmond County Board of Education. During Reconstruction, Georgia had founded its first statewide public school system. The 1872 law under which Richmond County established schools separated by race said, "The board shall provide the same facilities for each, both as regards schoolhouses and fixtures, attainments and abilities of teachers, length of time, and all other matters pertaining to education." By 1876, the board operated two schools for whites, one a girls' school and the other a coeducational school in the community of Hepzibah. Black leaders in Augusta asked for a high school. In 1878, the superintendent of schools gave his support, saying, "To grant today the petition of the colored people would be only an act of tardy justice." In 1880, Ware High School was founded, the only high school in the state for African Americans. Within a year, the superintendent wrote, "The colored high school has been a complete success." In 1897, a board committee recommended taking the money going to Ware High School and using it instead to hire additional teachers for the African American elementary schools. Leading black citizens petitioned for Ware to remain open, but the board voted to close it. African Americans, led by Joseph W. Cumming, James Harper, and John Ladevese, hired attorneys who asked for a restraining order to stop the board from collecting taxes for white high schools. Richmond County Superior Court Judge Enoch Calloway agreed with the plaintiffs and ordered the board not to collect tax money for the white school unless there was a facility for black students. The board took the case to the Georgia Supreme Court, which reversed Judge Calloway's decision. Cumming and his co-plaintiffs appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which confirmed the Georgia Supreme Court decision in 1899. The court said that establishing high schools was not required by the laws of the time, so the Board of Education could set them up according to their own judgment. The Supreme Court saw education as a state matter because at that time state taxes paid for schools. The federal government, the court said, had no say unless rights were violated. The court ruled that because it could find no desire or purpose to discriminate, the Board of Education did not violate the 14th Amendment. Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote that the African American plaintiffs had failed to demonstrate that the school board had been motivated by hostility because of race. The Plessy case had allowed for separation but required equality. In the Cumming decision, it was clear that defending equality was going to be a challenge for the African American community.